Let's turn back to Psalm 32. Psalm 32, and this will be our passage to hopefully prepare our hearts for the Lord's table this morning. Psalm 32. We're all aware that we are in a very controversial period here in our nation with these elections coming up. And things are heating up with the big primary contest, Super Tuesday, this coming week. And certainly there are going to be many things said that will be igniting disputes among people. One of the things that comes up often at this time of transition in the presidency is the matter of presidential pardons. The privilege that these men in high office have to make judgment calls about people who are guilty of crimes and different offenses, and to let them off the hook, really. And often this is something that presidents take advantage on their way out, I suppose because at that point they have nothing to worry about as far as public opinion. Sometimes the power is used in what seems to be an illegitimate and favoritist kind of way. But nevertheless, that is one of the unusual privileges that our president has. Now, usually people do tend to have an opinion about that. And so to avoid controversy, I'm going to give you an example that is very old that I don't think very many people would care about. In 1791, Secretary of State was Alexander Hamilton, and he was very concerned about the financial pressure on the different states of the new Union to pay the debts of the Revolutionary War. And what he did was he convinced the government to take on federally the responsibility for paying those bills. And on top of that, he convinced the Congress to set up some new taxes to be able to pay the debt. One of those taxes was actually a tax on liquor sales. And, of course, he was thinking that that would be one way to get money, but also hoping that it would help to promote moderation in the country. And so they established that tax at that time. It had a devastating effect, actually, on the economy, especially among farmers that were on the western frontier. Because often they would take their grain and would sell it to be used for the making of liquor. And so they naturally reacted against the pressure from the government, and it turned out to be a lot more expensive on the smaller farmers than on the bigger producers. And it created a real problem there in the early history of our nation. A few years later, in 1794, these farmers got together and they actually revolted against the federal government. They took up arms and were creating great upheaval, so much so that the government, for the first time ever, ended up taking arms against its own people to put down what ended up being called the Whiskey Rebellion. And actually, George Washington himself, first president of our country, led the army, about 13,000 soldiers, up to western Pennsylvania to put down these rebels. Now, when they got there, the people had basically gotten scared off, and the whole thing sort of disbanded all of a sudden. The army ended up rounding up a number of prisoners that were tried and charged for various crimes. And as the thing developed, the whole story turned, because Washington decided that he was going to end up pardoning all those people, actually two of those men, some of the leaders, were convicted of treason. They had been condemned to death by hanging. And in July of 1795, Washington totally pardoned those men. By the time he left office, the whole thing had been forgotten under this presidential pardon that he had granted. And here was the man who led the charge against the rebels and who was prepared, if necessary, to kill them in battle. And Washington turned out to be the very one who dismissed all the charges against them and who freed them from the death that they deserved. Now, usually, a presidential pardon is something you have to formally request. And actually, you may not have known this, there's something called the Office of the Pardon Attorney that reviews these requests as they come into the president's office. Over the last 30 years, an average of about 600 of these requests have come in each year, and about 10% of those are typically granted by the president. I would say you would have to be pretty desperate and pretty bold, knowing that you're guilty of some crime, to write the President of the United States and ask him to let you off the hook. But in fact, about 600 people a year do that. Now, I think that has everything to do with what we are considering this morning. All of us naturally hesitate to ask God's forgiveness. I think we tend to be so aware, in a good way, of God's holiness, and so aware of our own failures, and so remembering of all the times we've come before, that the thought of coming again and owning up to our sin and pleading with Him to cleanse us can be a little bit overwhelming. And we don't really have that boldness to just come and say, God, I was wrong. Would you have mercy on me? Well, if we ever fear that God will not accept us, I think Psalm 32 would be a great way to answer that hesitancy that we feel. You may know that it's commonly held this psalm is supposed to be the reflection of King David. His name is in the title. His reflection after having been forgiven by God of his great sins. Sin of adultery with Bathsheba. Sin of murder with her husband Uriah. Sin of deception that was all embroiled with that and trying to cover his sin from others and from God. And the Lord brought him to the point that we see reflected here in this psalm. And looking back on that whole experience, we have this man rejoicing in the greatness of God's forgiveness. Now, if God could do this work of forgiveness for David, my point is there any conceivably worse combination of sins in your life that you would think that God is unwilling to cleanse if you will take this posture? Surely you can conclude from the greater to the lesser that God is willing. And through Christ, God is able. This has been a favorite psalm of many people through the history of the church. And I discovered that it was the favorite psalm of St. Augustine. In fact, one commentator said that Augustine had it inscribed on the wall next to his bed before he died because he wanted to have it there close to him to meditate on. And he said he liked it because, quote, the beginning of knowledge is really knowing God and knowing what's going on in life. The beginning of knowledge is to know oneself to be a sinner. And this psalm kept that thought before him. But this morning I'd like to add to what Augustine said, that if the beginning of knowledge is to know yourself to be a sinner, the climax of knowledge is to know God to be a sin forgiver. The climax of knowledge is to know God as a sin forgiver. And this morning, I'd like us to look at this psalm and consider the blessing of God's forgiveness. We see here in these first two verses an exclamation on the part of David as he is considering what he has received. He is just thrilled about it that he just overflows with these words of excitement. And he is overwhelmed with the enviable state that is created by this forgiveness of God. And that would be our first consideration from these two verses. Forgiveness creates an enviable state. And I'm getting that from this word blessed, which occurs a couple of times here. I'm sure you've heard this word a number of times in preaching and in reading the Psalms and even the Beatitudes. It is a word that actually, in the original language, is plural. And is not talking about any one single or particular kind of blessing. It's just a way of talking about the many and overwhelming blessings that this person has. So you could actually better translate it, oh, the blessednesses. Oh, the innumerable blessings that belong to the person in this condition. It's a way of talking about how fortunate their state is. And so much so that it conveys the idea that people looking at this individual just find themselves naturally wishing that were them. That's why I say an enviable state. You see somebody in this condition and you find yourself desiring to be in their shoes. Not so much the idea of their being happy emotionally, but that they're in a happy or desirable circumstance that anybody would desire for themselves. Now, there are many biblical descriptions of what would go into being in that state. And this is the second time in the Psalter that you have a psalm beginning with this word. The first you might be able to recall, and that is Psalm 1. The one that brings up the whole collection under this heading, this initial note, Psalm 1:1, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. And somebody says, well, yes, naturally, I would think that the Bible would be trying to encourage people to live that way. And so they say, wow, what a wonderful position of life it would be to be a person who doesn't follow the example of sinners and who meditates on the law of God. Sure, you'd expect the Bible to say that. But here, it's like in the second time that a psalm begins with those words, the author is saying the very opposite. He is not rejoicing over the enviable state of somebody good. He is rejoicing over the enviable state of somebody who's a terrible sinner. Do you realize that? You don't have to be perfect to be in what the Bible would consider an enviable, happy position. And if anything, this psalm is an even greater blessing than Psalm 1. Because Psalm 1 presents to us a kind of standard toward which we're all progressing. And Psalm 2 is saying, look, even if you fail the standard, there is still blessing available for you in God. And that blessing is all wrapped up in the contrast in these two verses between how bad sin is and the degree to which God responds, the way in which God responds to sin. The contrast between how bad sin is and what it is God does with sin. And you have three words for sin, and then three corresponding words for God's response to that sin. Look with me at verse 1. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. The word transgression there is one that reminds us that sin is not an accident. It's a term that means willful rebellion. We just talked about these rebels up there in Pennsylvania a few hundred years ago. That's the word. These are people who are revolting against the authority of God. That's what transgression is. The next verse, the end of verse 1 first says, whose sin is covered. And there is a second part of the vocabulary of sin. Sin is such a many-sided, horrible thing that in Hebrew anyway, it takes about a dozen words to picture for you just how bad it is. And this is one of them. This is the word that we commonly define as missing the mark. As the idea of God setting up a standard, kind of like a target that you'd want to be shooting an arrow at. And no matter how hard you try and no matter how carefully you aim, you always fall short. You never even come close to the target. There's another word in verse 2. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord does not impute iniquity. There's the third word, iniquity, which is a term that refers to sin as something twisted. The idea being that God has made us originally straight, or that He has put us on a straight and direct path. And through our choices, we've gotten the thing all twisted and bent out of shape. We are people whose lives are crooked. People whose choices are twisting what God set forth as straight. Three words for wrongdoing. And the point is not that we want to make real fine distinctions between these words, or to think that David is associating one word with one sin or something like that. It's the idea of just heaping up a number of words to try to paint as black a picture as possible of how bad sin is. And one commentator helpfully summarized the meaning of the three words in this way. He says, sin is defiance, transgression. Sin is defect, missing the mark. Sin is distortion, crookedness. Defiance, defect, distortion. Have you done anything like that this week? Have you done anything like that since the last time that we were gathered here to celebrate the Lord's Supper? For you to look at your sin and call it that is the first step toward being in this position of blessing. In response to those three words for sin, God has three things that He does. First of all, it says, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. And the word forgiven there is a word that basically means to pick something up and to carry it away. To remove it entirely from the picture. Just like every week, you take your trash can out to the curb and the truck comes and dumps it in there and takes it off and dumps it far out of sight, never to be seen again by you. That's the idea. This sin is picked up, carried away, and done away with. The next word, whose sin is covered. You don't want to think here covering in the sense of just kind of superficially putting it out of sight, but it really is still there. And at any moment, God can lift the lid and remind you of it. That's not the idea. I like the way that back in Genesis, this word is used to talk about the waters of the flood covering the entire earth. And so much so that it covered all the mountains and the highest mountain peaks were submerged 20 feet underwater. That's the idea. Totally submerged. Totally covered. Inaccessible. Out of sight. And unlike the waters of the flood, which eventually receded, and you could see, once again, the mountain peaks, these waters are not going away. They are buried in the depth of the deepest sea. My sin is gone. That was the experience of this man, even under the old covenant. And he goes on and gives us another word in verse 2. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity. That's a legal term having to do with legal charges, or it could also be used talking about money and accounting. Just like you are racking up a bill on your credit card and there are these charges that are going against your name and you get this monthly bill. Or you go to the store with a cart full of goods and they are ringing it all up. And at the end of the thing, they are saying, this is how much you owe. We're getting ready to charge you for this. Imagine going to God, and you've got a list a mile long of offenses against Him and charges that He rightfully has against you. And He says, I'm just going to totally erase this debt. I'm not going to charge you with all that you have racked up against me. That is what He is saying here. The Lord does not impute iniquity to us. So you have three things God does corresponding to the three words for sin. But maybe the end of verse 2 could be a little confusing. It says, and in whose spirit there is no guile. All along we've been talking about this person actually being quite deceitful, actually being quite twisted and devious. That's the whole problem. That's what he needs forgiveness for. So why is he saying here, in whose spirit is no guile, as though somehow he's trying to justify himself or present his own works and effort as some kind of reason to get mercy from God? I don't think that's the conclusion that we want to come to, given the entirety of the psalm. It seems to be that he is preparing us for the next few verses, in whose spirit there is no guile. The sense would be, here's the kind of person God forgives. Somebody who's not trying to pull the wool over God's eyes and pretend like there's nothing wrong. He doesn't come to God trying to hide things, trying to deceive God into thinking that everything's okay. No, this is a person who doesn't deny what he has done, but is very open and frank and transparent about his failures. And that person, and that kind of person alone, is the person who ends up experiencing this blessing. That is a condition. Which brings us to the next stanza, verses 3 to 5. And the second point about forgiveness. In the first two verses, we found an exclamation. In these verses, we find an example. And here's what we learn from the example of David's own life. The point would be in these verses that forgiveness results from sincere confession. Forgiveness results from sincere confession. It is first an enviable condition. And if somebody says, how can I end up in that position? Well, here's what you would need to do. This is a result of confession. And verses 3 to 4 recount for us the misery that David experienced during a time. And if it was during those times after his sin with Bathsheba, you'd be talking here about approximately a year's time in which he was unwilling to own up what he had done. And in very graphic terms, he describes his experience, whether he's talking directly about physical anguish, which is very possible, or whether this is a metaphor for his spiritual struggles. Either way, it was an agonizing time. He says in verse 3 that his bones waxed old. He felt like somebody elderly who is laid up and unable to move because their bones are brittle and they're falling apart. He lost his strength. He goes on to say in verse 3 at the end that he was groaning, or roaring as it says here. He was groaning all day long because of the weight of his sin upon his conscience. He says in verse 4, I felt like God was pushing down on me. His hand was heavy upon me with conviction. And another way of picturing it, my moisture is turned into the drought of summer. I felt like some scrub out there in the desert that had maybe just a little bit of moisture left, and the sun came up and beat down on me and totally evaporated whatever was there that I could draw vitality from, and I felt like I was left out there in the heat of summer to wither. I had no vitality. All of my strength, all of my joy, all of my comfort, it was all sapped away. He felt like he was being tortured until he came to a point of confession. It sounds a little harsh, right, that God would put somebody through what amounts to torture to get them to confess. Torture is not a fun thing to think about. That's another big issue in our country today. What does and does not constitute torture to get people to tell you things? A couple of summers ago, we were in Spain, and we were doing some sightseeing in a town and just happened to run across a little museum of torture instruments that they would have used during the Spanish Inquisition. These were supposed to be some of the actual implements of torture that survived and were there on display for people to see. I decided to go. And in fact, I decided to take my two boys because I thought it would be a good thing for them to see what people had suffered for Christ. I kind of regret I did, at least that I took them, because a few of the things were so grotesque that they could have given me nightmares. And I won't get into all the details, but I do want to share with you a couple of things because I think it makes the point of what's happening here. They had this big wheel, kind of like a Russian roulette, that they would strap somebody to and turn them around. And at the bottom of the wheel, there was a trough that they filled with all this old, dirty water so that at the turn, a person's head would end up in there. And they would leave him in there feeling like he was drowning for a few minutes and then bring him back up and see if he would talk. And this would go on, and he'd be in there longer and longer until he fessed up or died or they just happened to have mercy on him. They had a metal face mask with a big snout right here where your nose would be. And this little flap that you open up, they would open it up and they would put an insect in there. And the idea would be the insect would go straight up your nose and drive you crazy and get into your brain and maybe even kill you. Again, a way of making you miserable until you talk. Now, that sounds pretty harsh, sounds pretty cruel, and you say, would God really make me go through an experience like that until I talk? I was struck with what Spurgeon said. He said, the rack, the wheel, the flames of the stake are ease compared with the hell which a guilty conscience kindles within the breast. Better suffer all the diseases which flesh is heir to than lie under the crushing sense of the wrath of Almighty God. The Spanish Inquisition, with all its tortures, was nothing to the inquest which conscience holds within the heart. Undealt with conviction really can drive you crazy. And that is, in fact, what is going on, why God has equipped us with this mechanism that we call the conscience. It is not out of an effort to just make us squirm. He doesn't get his thrills out of seeing us uncomfortable. But would you rather go through that now as a sinner and be brought to confession? Or would you rather suffer the torments of a lake of fire for all eternity separated from God? And even the life of a Christian, would you rather go through life cut off from fellowship with God and never knowing where you stand from before Him, and experiencing chastening after chastening after chastening, as opposed to the Lord putting some pressure on you and His hand being heavy on you out of love until you get that thing straightened out and you experience the immediate relief that this man comes to know after all of that? As you read in verse 5, here's the turning point. He finally gives in. I acknowledged my sin unto thee. My iniquity have I not hid. I said, I will confess my transgressions unto the Lord. It's fascinating that he uses the same three words for sin that showed up in verses 1 and 2. He uses them all to speak of his own sin. I acknowledged them. I took responsibility. He says as well, I have not hid my iniquity. And that word hid is the same term that up in verse 1 is translated covered. You see that? He is saying, I'm not going to cover my sin anymore. And God is saying, okay, now I'm going to cover your sin. Or as the Puritan Richard Sibbes says, the way to cover our sin is to uncover it by confession. Or as the writer of Proverbs says in 28:13, he that covereth, here's that same word, He that covereth his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. And mercy is what this man gets right away. Listen to how the verse flows. I mean, he goes right from the confession, very next thought, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sin. It was immediate. God did not look at him and laugh and say, I told you so, you idiot. There was no delay on the part of God, no questioning, no playing with his emotions, no conditions, no threats, no rubbing it in his face. God was freed up to give him immediate relief from that conviction. It's kind of like when you have a blister on your hand. They're not working, maybe, and using your hands in a way you're not used to, and it gets rubbed so much that you got this blister and you got this big thing on there, and while it's there, it is just agonizing you, this burning feeling, and like something's going to burst, and you, what do? You take a little needle, right? And you just barely prick it, and all of a sudden it's like, the pressure is off. And very quickly, the pain goes away. That is precisely how forgiveness works. The thing mounts and mounts until you can't stand it anymore, and as soon as the words are out of your mouth, God, I was wrong, have mercy, your sin is covered. That really is the way it works for the Christian, that if we confess our sins, He is faithful and He is righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And then we come to the final section of the psalm. We have seen, first of all, an example. Earlier, we saw the exclamation. And now at the end, we come to an exhortation, where he's basically turned into a preacher at this point. The tone changes all of a sudden when he experiences this relief. It is a tone of joy and confidence and even challenge. Actually, there, verse 6, the way it reads in the King James Version, for this shall everyone that is godly, etc., really is more of an exhortation. It would read like this, therefore, let everyone who is godly, etc., etc. All the way through here, the rest of this passage, he is preaching. He is exhorting. Maybe actually a fulfillment of the comment that he made back in chapter 51 and verse 13, that once God forgives him, he says, then will I teach transgressors thy way, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. And as we look at these exhortations, I think we can sum it up in three lessons. The point that we're looking at here in these verses is that forgiveness yields rich lessons. There are these steps of growth that go on in your life. There is this greater awareness of certain spiritual principles. There are these truths now that you're so convinced of yourself, you want to share with other people. And what are these rich lessons that are yielded by forgiveness? First of all, verses 6 to 7. Go to God, not away from Him, when you're in trouble. Listen to what he says. Therefore, shall everyone that is godly, that is somebody who is a faithful covenant relationship with God, pray unto thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in the floods of great waters they shall not come nigh unto him. Thou art my hiding place. Shall preserve me from trouble. Shall compass me about with songs of deliverance. You see how he, having experienced something of the embrace and protection of God in a time of sin, is saying, look, God can do this for you as well. And specifically, the topic under discussion here is sin and forgiveness. That would be the main kind of trouble, the main kind of disaster that a person is facing, though it would certainly apply to any other kind of trouble. He's saying, don't run away from God. And I'm sure you've had the experience. As a child, if your parents disciplined you, they just had this instinctive reaction when they went to spank you, to slap you. What do you want to do? You just, without even thinking, you pull back. You move from the person who's chastening you. And he is saying that is exactly the wrong thing to do in a case like this. You don't run away from the hand that's chastening you. You run toward the hand that's chastening you. That is how you get into a position of protection. He pictures it here in terms of water that may be threatening your life. You think of these dry riverbeds in the desert over there that somebody might be taking a hike in, and all of a sudden there's a flash flood, and there's this gush of water that they didn't anticipate, and they're about getting ready to get swallowed up by this flood. And God reaches down and plucks them out. That's the idea there. As we read verse 6, surely in the floods of great waters they shall not come nigh unto him. Look as well at the statement in verse 6 that we ought to seek the Lord when thou mayest be found. That certainly implies that there might come a time. There might come a time when there is no longer as much an opportunity, particularly for the lost and even with the saved. We could end up getting ourselves so embroiled in sin that though God forgives us, there's just this mountain of consequences that God is not just going to step in and solve for us. One translation says, while there is a window of opportunity, that's when you need to run to Him as soon as possible, before the thing festers any worse, before you get yourself entangled any more. He's not just going to protect you from the surrounding pressures. Verse 7 says He's actually going to surround you with songs of deliverance. So that's the first lesson. Go to God and not away from Him when you're in trouble. Verses 8 to 10, the second lesson. Don't be hard to work with. Don't be hard to work with. And it seems to be that God Himself is speaking in verses 8 and 9. Or maybe David is recounting something the Lord ministered to him. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. Or more literally, I'm going to counsel you with a favorable eye towards you. In other words, God is looking out for your best interest. His eye is on you. He is on your behalf, looking out for you. And this is what's going to be for your own good, He says. Be not as the horse, or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle. The idea would be, otherwise, it is if you don't put the bit and bridle in, they're not going to come near to you. One translation says, do not be like an unintelligent horse or mule, which will not obey you unless they're controlled by a bridle and bit. Now, I'm no farmer, and I have very little experience with horses, but I think I understand what's being said here. It is a simple illustration. And you know, sometimes with all this conviction and pressure God's putting on us, we may feel like He is kicking me around and He's treating me like an animal. And the author says, well, that's because you're acting like a dumb animal. You are resisting Him. And you're just getting what you're asking for. He is appealing to you on the basis of your own good. Look at verse 10. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked. Is that what you want? Or do you want to be in this position? He that trusts in the Lord, God's covenant loyalty is the idea. God's going to come through for you in tenderness and affection and commitment. That's what's going to surround you. It's no longer the threats, no longer the conviction, no longer the pressure. It's the covenant loyalty of God. And so the second lesson is, don't be hard to work with. Number three and finally, delight in the joy of a clean conscience and a forgiving God. Delights in the joy of a clean conscience and a forgiving God. Verse 11, be glad in the Lord and rejoice, ye righteous, and shout for joy, all ye that are upright in heart. Remember back in verse 3, he said that his bones were waxing old and he was groaning all day long. Here's a man who has somehow gone from groaning to a point where he is so happy he is actually encouraging other people to shout for joy. From groaning to singing, we might say. And again, don't think that when he talks about the righteous and the upright in heart, he is saying that these people are perfect. The whole point all along has been these people are meeting God's standards in this sense. They are not trying to hide their imperfections. They are not resisting the pressure of God. They are just openly and gladly acknowledging their faults, and this is their lot in life. It reminds me of the experience of Christian in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress as he was going up the hill toward the cross. It says, he ran thus till he came at a place somewhat ascending, and upon that place stood a cross, and a little below in the bottom, a sepulcher. So I saw in my dream that just as Christian came up with a cross, his burden loosed from off his shoulders and fell off from his back. And it began to tumble, and so continued to do till it came to the mouth of the sepulcher, where it fell in, and I saw it no more. His sins were covered. Then was Christian glad and lightsome, and said with a merry heart, he hath given me rest by his sorrow and life by his death. Then he stood still a while to look and wonder, for it was very surprising to him that simply the sight of the cross should thus ease his burden. He looked therefore and looked again, even though the springs that were in his head sent the waters down his cheeks. Now as he stood looking and weeping, behold, three shining ones came to him and saluted him, saying, peace be to thee. So the first said to him, thy sins be forgiven thee. The second stripped him of his rags and clothed him with the change of raiment. The third set a mark on his forehead and gave him a roll with a seal on it, which he bid him look on as he ran, and that he should give it in at the celestial gate. And so they went their way. And isn't this the spirit of Psalm 32? As he goes along the way, he gave three leaps for joy and went on singing. Thus far did I come laden with my sin, nor could aught ease the grief that I was in till I came hither. What a place is this! Must here be the beginning of my bliss? Must here the burden fall from off my back? Must here the strings that bound it to me crack? Blessed cross, blessed sepulcher, blessed rather be the man that was there put to shame for me. It is that spirit of exaltation that somebody experiences when they've finally known the relief of sin. And I think we're justified to begin talking about the cross and transitioning to the Lord's table on the basis of Psalm 32, especially because this is one of two incidents in the Old Testament that the Apostle Paul brings up in Romans chapter 4 to teach the doctrine of justification by faith. Actually, Martin Luther called this psalm one of the Pauline Psalms, because it reminded him so much of this truth of our justification and forgiveness in Christ. And Paul brings it up as a proof that everybody at any time who has ever been declared righteous before God, it has not been on the basis of their own perfection, but simply casting themselves on the Lord in humility, in trust. That is the experience of King David. And so I think it is a wonderful statement of the gospel to be thinking about as we come to the Lord's Supper. It's a psalm that celebrates the joy of sins forgiven, and it assures us that God does not begrudge forgiving us. This morning, we were getting ready to leave. We were in the kitchen, and on our refrigerator, we have one of these calendars that you write on every month with a dry erase marker. And I realized, well, we're in a new month now. So somebody's going to have to get a paper towel and something wet and wipe it off and write in the new days of the month and what we're supposed to be doing this month. And here we are at the beginning of a new month in our church life, beginning of a quarter, and we have an opportunity, like the Lord's Supper, to entirely wipe the slate clean with God and come to Him not as a horse or a mule, but as a humble, trusting believer and say, God, this is me, transgression, iniquity, sin. I can't even imagine how bad this is. My words are too few to describe how bad things are. But I believe what I have seen here, and I trust in Christ, and once again, I am pleading with you for mercy. That really is one of the great blessings of the Lord's table, that it confronts us with our sin by reminding us of what our sin did to Christ, so that we can again experience the joy of forgiveness and the glory of the gospel.